Welcome to the latest episode of High Stakes. I'm Paige Soya, Managing Director of K Street Capital. And today's episode is all about exits. And we have Rami Hussain on our episode today. And this is very exciting because he's been through multiple exits himself as a founder, also as an angel investor, and lots of different kinds of exits. So I'll let him share a little bit about that. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, Rami, and then we'll dig in on some of these things.
Hey, thanks for having me, Paige. As mentioned, my name's Rami, serial entrepreneur. Started my first company out of college, dropped out of college actually for that. Ran it for a year when I was acqui-hired by a friendly. Went into the corporate world and did product in a couple of roles in corporate. And then I was drawn back to entrepreneurship. And so I started my second company, ran it for 9 years. It was called Distill Networks. We raised $60 million, had a nine-figure exit, venture-backed, built that company in San Francisco and sold that in 2019. Then started in 2020, a company called Finmark. Ran that until last year when we got acquired prematurely, but it was an offer too good to say no to. So that was my third exit. And now I'm at Bill.com as SVP of product. That's who acquired my company.
Well, why don't we kick it off with, let's just go one by one, actually. I'll start with your first exit, how that played out, and then the second one and the third one, because I know they were all very different in the way that they exited.
Yeah. So the first one was an employer that I had worked for. I actually, funny enough, I was selling cell phones in the mall when I was paying my way through college. And I realized that, it would be so much easier if I just, this thing called the internet was just, kind of ramping up. And so I built an e-commerce storefront to sell cell phones and kind of branch out on my own as opposed to selling them, manually in person. The company that I was working for acquired the website, the web infrastructure, and made that their e-commerce site. So it was, took what I was doing, learned from it, brought it into the digital age, and then the company that I was working for brought me back in. So that was the first experience of, getting acquired, not running a process. They gave us an offer and, we were young and we just said, yeah, that sounds great. Okay, cool. And, had a six-figure payday and we felt good about it.
Yep. How long did you have that company before it sold?
A year. So that's why we were pretty amazing. We felt pretty good.
We're pretty happy. Yeah.
It's more money than I had ever made. So.
Yeah. That's awesome. And then the second one, the bigger one, this is the one you were with for 9 years, right?
Yeah. So we were running Distill Networks for 9 years. We had raised a lot of money, had tier one investors, and Our growth started slowing down. We were originally growing, 300%, then 200%. Towards the end, we were growing about 50% year over year when we were kind of in the mid-20s in terms of revenue. With kind of the stagnating growth, 50% is great for an at-scale business, but the trend line didn't look good in terms of our growth. So when we got an initial offer from a competitor to acquire us, my investors really wanted to explore it. We agreed to run a process and see what else, we could turn up. And we ran a whole process for about 6 months and ended up selling to a strategic investor that was owned by Thoma Bravo. So Thoma Bravo led the negotiations and then rolled us into one of their portfolio companies.
Okay. Did you run a process or it was just that one acquirer kind of reached out with a bid and... Yeah.
When we got the first bid, we told them we were going to run a process and we hired a banker and ran a process. A lot of learnings that we can come back to about bankers and running a process. But yeah, we were able to nudge the acquisition price up, but not to a place where I was really happy with. And I wished, that one was a bittersweet one for me because I was alone on one side of the table, hoping that we would keep going. Whereas the investors and even my co-founders at the time were like, hey, a bird in the hand, let's go ahead and take the exit now.
So you were, I guess, outvoted on that one. I'm sure you were on your board still at that point, but yeah.
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 Yeah. I was still chairman of the board, but it's one of those things where that you can't build it alone. And so if you're going to fight everybody to try to, continue to drive forward, I wouldn't have been able to do it without the support of my investors, without the support of my co-founders. And it wasn't worth blowing up kind of where things were.
And so after you sold, how long did you stay on with the company? Was there sort of an earn out, or how was that structured?
Yeah, there was a 1 year earn out that I did not make. I left pretty quickly afterwards, both because most of the money did get paid, right? There's like an incentive portion that was held back to earn out. But a lot of the handshakes of the negotiations, I felt like weren't honored after the fact. And so I think to me and my employees that like, we weren't really welcomed. We weren't really taken care of. We were kind of siloed and we didn't really have a seat at the table. So I was out really early, leaving money on the table, but I wasn't the only one. If you look at that acquisition, 50% of the staff that came over left within the first year.
Wow. That's pretty wild. Did you feel like when the whole transaction went down, right? Like the day after, I know that things changed as you got into it and as the merger sort of got implemented, but in that moment, how did you feel about the other stakeholders, like the employees, yourself, the other founders, the investors? Did they feel like this was a good, like they were being treated fairly and they were happy about the deal, or were there certain stakeholders that, you know, maybe felt differently?
I think everybody around the table felt like this was okay. Right? This was just okay. But again, this is coming from a place of turbulence for us as a standalone company, right? We were burning too much money. You know, our growth wasn't growing nearly what it was before. We were going to have to really cut back burn and at the same time really like lean into a couple of product offerings that would have like hopefully reaccelerated things, right? Like everybody had to believe that like what we were working on was going to work. And so there was a little bit of hope and faith that people needed to have around the table to say, hey, things are going to get better. And people were tired, right? And nine years in, it was a long journey. So this felt like a relief for a lot of people. They were like, hey, this is just okay, but it's a relief. We're not stressed anymore.
Yeah. And if you don't mind me asking, were the terms of the deal, was it an all cash deal or was it partially stock, or how did that get structured?
That one was all cash.
All cash.
That deal was all cash.
And what year was this?
2019.
Okay. Yeah. So heading into the next era, I'm interested to hear the third exit story, which is in 2022. Is that right?
Yeah, 2022. Okay. We started the company right at the beginning of the pandemic, and you know, was able to raise a crazy amount of money, the easiest fundraises I've ever had in my career. Right, the combined ZIRP with like the money printing that was happening. You know, anybody that's listening to this knows that venture was crazy, right? So we raised $12 million for a seed company that had no revenue. Right. Really based off of my prior track record. And we sprinted. I had a burn of what would be a Series A company. We hired 30 employees that had worked for me before and really built an awesome product and something that would have taken probably 3 to 5 years to build. We did in under two because of the heavy burn. And as I was about to go out for my Series A, the market was turning. The venture dollars were tightening, and I had been nurturing a deal off to the side to keep optionality open going into my Series A. And it became clear to me that this was the better path.
So I think that's so smart that you were nurturing a deal on the side. Like, were you doing that intentionally because you could see the writing on the wall kind of with the market, or was that just coincidence?
I was doing it intentionally because of a lesson that I learned from my second company. We ended up selling Distill Networks to Thoma Bravo and Imperva. Imperva, 4 years prior to buying us, they had actually made an acquisition offer that I turned down. I was not interested in my second company to talk to any competitors about any acquisitions. We were gung-ho all the way. That offer would have actually paid us out more, even though it was half as much 4 years earlier, right? And so that was a, like, in reflecting on that deal, I took away that, like, you know what, just like I'm always fundraising, like I got very good at that. Like, I'm always talking to my next investors, keeping up a network. you don't stop as a CEO fundraising. And I realized I shouldn't stop selling as well. Like, I need to keep a pipeline of healthy opportunities to sell for optionality. And so I had that lens in mind when I was building my third company, and I was constantly entertaining any kind of conversations with corp dev.
And thank the Lord, because the way the market went in that time, especially if you had a, you know, if you raised that much at a C and you're burning a lot trying to raise an A, it was like the worst of all the worlds at the same moment.
With convertible debt. With safe notes.
Okay. Yeah.
So imagine doing a price rounds and converting all of that. It was going to be, catastrophic.
I will just say also for the audience, like, I've seen this a number of times with, we've had a few founders that we've invested in. It's similarly, we're sort of always keeping a side deal hot for an exit all along, even though they might not have been telling us that. But actually, I'm so glad that they did, because in each of the cases, they had a very fast and positive exit for us, because they were, you know, because they were sort of like, you know, sort of doing that side planning. And I think most people don't think about that.
It's so funny that you say without telling you. My investors, like, when the deal was done, thought I'd like pulled a rabbit out of the hat. Right. They were just where did this come from?
Exactly,
because
right.
Like, you know what? Like, it wasn't meaningful to bring up, right? This was keeping doors open. It was optional, something that I kept warm. I don't tell investors everything that I'm doing in every part of my day. And so it felt like it came out of nowhere for them. And I was like, well, no, I have been working on those activities for over a year. You know, so.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a good thing. And I think it's a good lesson for people to hear, especially for founders that haven't been through it multiple times like you have. But looking back at all those things, I guess I'm wondering, you know, you've done ones where you've run a process. Maybe let's start there. You mentioned the bankers and things you might have done differently with the banking process. Why don't we talk about that for a second?
Okay. So I first came away with the conclusion that bankers in a process that's under $250 million are only helpful for making introductions. And so if you are diligent to know the ecosystem, to have relationships with, to keep doors open, to talk to competitors, to talk to corp dev, you don't need a banker. In fact, they ended up being like real estate agents, where frankly, they were selling us as much as they were selling, you know, us to the buyer. Because at the end of the day, they get paid on a transaction fee. Right. And so just like a realtor, they're going to talk up the house that they're showing you. They're not going to talk up the flaws. They're going to want you to buy it. And that's how I felt through that whole process. And so I don't feel like incentives are directly aligned there with a banker in a smaller transaction, or at least the value, I don't think is necessarily there.
You might be right. I have been through a number. We've seen a number where the bankers were instrumental because the company is at early stages, and maybe you weren't really at that early of a stage anymore per se, but depending what stage you're at, sometimes the companies are just, you know, kind of a mess, and their financials are a mess, and even being able to make it through a diligence process is a challenge, I think, for those types of companies, or understanding what things mean in an M&A transaction. You, on the other hand, maybe have been through it a few times. You sort of understood it. And maybe you guys had your ducks in a row. In that case, I can see why the banker wouldn't really add that much value. Especially if you ended up taking the deal you had even in the beginning before you brought a banker in, right?
Yeah.
So that's what ended up happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I assume you still had to pay them.
We still had to pay them
all along. And I imagine you excluded that buyer from the list of...
We couldn't exclude the buyer, but we discounted that buyer.
Yes. It's an interesting question for companies, so depending on where they are in their life cycle and how much experience they have with all. I mean, we hear different things from everybody that we talk to on this podcast.
I could totally see your point. I could totally see your point. If you need modeling help, if you want to clean up your data room, if you want somebody that can call out that like, hey, this isn't going to fly, it'd be helpful to have, you know, the bankers, you know, do clean everything up.
That aside, though, looking back, what are, I guess, if you have to think about the things you would have done differently in some of these transactions, or things you wish you had known before you'd been through a transaction or sold any of your businesses, what would those things be?
I think the first thing that I give founders advice on is that you really need to understand why the company's buying you, right? Oftentimes, most times it's strategic, right? If you're selling the PE, then it really is an evaluation of what you're worth. But if you're selling to a strategic, it's not about what you're worth. It's about what you're worth to them. And so really understanding the business model and their assumptions around, you know, what kind of growth, what kind of revenue, how you're going to be accretive to their business. If you can pull that out somehow, that's going to help you significantly in the negotiations and understanding, you know, how where their appetite is, where their mindset is at. We went through the second negotiation 100% around this is what we're worth as a company, right? Because of we had tens of millions of dollars in revenue. We had, you know, raised a bunch of money. And we should have extracted a lot more value strategically. In the third company, we were so early, there was no way in the world I was going to accept any kind of valuation based off of revenue, especially since I had had previous exits. I wanted to go all the way. So I pushed really hard to align around, hey, what strategic value are we going to bring? How do you see this? And that helped us get to, you know, a revenue multiple that like well over 100x, you know, in terms of what revenue was. Yeah.
That's amazing. That was gonna be one of the things I was gonna ask you is, having been through three of them, like, was it a revenue multiple? Were any of the companies profitable, and it was an EBITDA multiple?
No. None of the companies were multiple. None of them were EBITDA. The first one was just, you know, value of, you know, what we had built. The second one was a revenue multiple, effectively, but it was mediocre, right? It was like an 8x revenue multiple, which for, you know, a SaaS company isn't huge.
It's better than what we're seeing now, at least.
Very true. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, very interesting. And then what parts of the process, you know, you shared a little bit about that second exit, things that, you know, happened that you didn't expect after the deal closed. But thinking about all of the exits combined, or even some of the other, because I know you're an angel investor and you've been through exits on the other side of the table where you were on the investor side. But things that you just didn't expect that you sort of learned after the fact that wish you had known going into it.
You know, one of the biggest things that I thought was that when you kind of talk about a price, you know, verbally, or even write it down, you know, in an LOI, that's not a price that's anchored in anything, right? Like it always keeps moving. And I think that my lesson learned is that in these really high stakes negotiations, when we're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, you have professional people on the other side of this that do this for a living, especially like when we were going up against Thoma Bravo as a PE firm, right? And they understand this. This is a game. This is like the strategy here goes above and beyond. And the biggest lesson that I think I took away from that is, until somebody is willing to walk away, then the negotiations haven't stopped. And we weren't willing to walk away in my second negotiation. Where we started in terms of a verbal number got cut by 50% to get to, you know, when we finally signed the deal. Similarly, on the third exit, the first negotiations where I had, you know, thought we were starting from, the number that was finally presented was significantly lower than where my expectations were. And what I realized is that, like, on the other side of the table, these are professional bankers. These are professional, like, I dealt with Thoma Bravo. They do this for a living, right? And, you know, the negotiation isn't going to stop until somebody's willing to walk away. And that's what we did the third time. I literally said, no, I didn't push back. I didn't counter. I didn't, you know, that shows your hand so much, right? If you counter and you say, okay, my counter is X, like, you've now anchored, we just walked away. Like, literally just, you know, and then we reconnected a couple months later and picked back up and doubled the acquisition price.
That's awesome. That's a great piece of advice for people. And also, there's two other things I wanted to ask you. You sort of maybe touched on this a little bit, but I think founders think that there's certain things about their company that have value that actually don't, right? And then when you go to sell, you realize that's not actually the thing that matters. It's something else. And I'm curious, like, what things were sort of perceived value in your mind about your businesses that ended up really not mattering at all in the transaction?
You know, I think one of the things that really stood out to me was how much of our revenue was discounted because it wouldn't fall into their exact, you know, kind of pricing plan. They just, in their head, they just said, like, they just thought, hey, we're going to sunset this. Like, we didn't even say it out loud. And that was actually, I wish they had, because like, that was one of the reasons where I left. I was like, you're just ditching our customers. You're ditching a third of the customers. But like, they in their plans had like, hey, we were going to do this cloud only. We're not going to do this on-premise stuff anymore. That doesn't align. We're just going to shut that down. And so that discounted the revenue because they knew that was going to go away. And so making sure that like what you think is going to align in terms of their business model matters a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So last question for you. You mentioned that you're full-time now with Bill.com. And I'm curious how that's going for you as a founder, like having been the founder of three companies and gone through exits with all three and then going back to the sort of other world where you're working for somebody else. It's hard to do, I think.
Yeah. You know, I've got to say the team at Bill.com is amazing. Like the founder is one of the nicest, most generous, kind people that I've met that really cares about his employees and the customers. They've assembled a team of people that are just incredible to work with. It's still a huge adjustment for a founder that is used to moving fast, that especially a CEO that has, you know, authority to just make things happen and just like blast through walls. That's what you are conditioned to do as a founder. It's like, hey, obstacles in front of you, you have to pile drive through them. And unfortunately, in a corporate environment, I'm breaking a lot of things. I'm pissing people off. And not to say that I'm not like doing a good thing. They needed maybe a little bit of that. So some people appreciate it. Some people think I'm a jerk. But I don't want to lose what it is that makes me successful, which is just an unstoppable force of nature and, you know, an insatiable appetite to fix broken things. But it comes at a cost. It is taxing in a whole different way. But on the other side of it, I've reduced the stress of having to worry about the viability of the company, having to worry about the employees and, you know, will we have to fundraise to be able to make payroll? Some of these harder other decisions that really weigh heavy on you as a founder are just lifted. Like I don't think about work on the weekends. That's crazy to me.
Yeah.
You know, so
different stresses. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
100%.
Yeah. Do you think you'll ever start another business?
You know, I think I'm done 0 to 1. One of the things that I did a lot with Finmark is mentor a lot of founders because that was actually our customer base. We built a financial modeling software for startups to use to plan their you know, forecasts and metrics, et cetera. So I mentored a lot of founders and I found myself really passionate about that. I really enjoy helping others. And I want to facilitate others' success moving forward. So I don't know what that means for me exactly for the long term, but I'm not ready to sign up for another 0 to 1 just yet.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, thanks for all these insights. I guess I would just say anything else, any final thoughts you want to share before we wrap up?
I tell founders that this journey is hard, right? Like you building something of value is hard. You want to keep as many doors open, as many options open as possible as you're going through things, just so that you increase your odds of success, right? You know, I knew going into my third company that this was probably going to be my last 0 to 1. It's like when you get to a certain age and you decide you're no longer having any more kids, right? And this was going to be my last baby. And I really wanted it to go big. But I still knew that the right thing was to take this offer, the right thing for my shareholders, the right thing for me and my stress, the right thing for the employees and making sure that they had a safety net. And so a big part of things is keeping a door open. And even if you don't land the plane, right? Even if you don't get acquired, know that you're on a journey that has a high failure rate, right? Like the top 1% gets all the spoils and you know, 9 out of 10 of us are gonna fail, but that doesn't mean you did anything wrong. It's just as much luck as it is hard work.
Plus you get so much out of it from a learning perspective either way, I think. And it's like, as long as you're learning, if you're not learning anything and you're doing it, then that's kind of dumb. But if you're getting something out of it that adds value to your life later, it's worth it either way in a lot of cases. Sure. I think that's a great, great point. Well, thank you so much, Rami.
And that's a wrap for today's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed it, please leave us a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. Thanks.